study. That facility study is designed and intended to...
Is there any question that the facilities are falling apart? There's studies after studies after studies have shown that.
The facility, there are some facilities that have done that. There has been no systematic study in this state, Your Honor, that has attempted to look at facilities in terms of needs assessment, growth, and their relationship to the particular wealth of the district. There's certainly anecdotal testimony with respect to, and there was some in the first record in this case, but there are also, there is a significant number of poor districts in the state that pursue this as good facilities. Also have a situation in which we're attempting to find for the first time the practice of the districts, which is to, whether they actually fund facilities from maintenance and operation expenses that have been withheld or budgeted for, or through the bond and indebtedness route. And we're trying to define the pervasiveness of that practice. Until you find that out, you simply cannot design a facilities component that is going to be fair in terms of allocating to those that have already made the sacrifice how to help cover their bonded indebtedness versus those that haven't had the money versus a direct grant or expenditure to help them out. You have to find out where you are. Now, in the event that a separate facility component is not created, Senate Bill 1 commands that the cost of facilities be equalized in the cost factors set forth in Tier 2 of the system. That's operationally defined, and it is set forth in both 16008B5 and 16256E5. Those are complementary statutes. The language in both is virtually the same. That's why they're put together. One defines the role of the Foundation School Fund Budget Committee. That's 16256. And 16008 defines the role of the Legislative Education Board. Now, in connection with the issue Judge Phillips asked that said, well, are they only making recommendations to the legislature? And the answer is no, they are not. They have within the power, 16.256B, the power to reserve funds in the Foundation School Fund. That means that and I'll give you a hypothetical example. What that means is that in the event that a $6 billion is reserved for next year, and the legislature sees fit to only appropriate $5 billion for education, the comptroller may still, because of the reservation of funds, only certify revenues of $14 million as available, or $14 billion as available for other governmental functions. The reservation has that power in that fund. Judge McCowan misperceived the notion of that by looking at that 3.22 of the government code, which has a significantly different function, which is simply to tell, to command the Legislative Budget Board to put the numbers in there so the legislature has some kind of idea how much the weights cost in actual dollars rather than as expressed as percentages. That's the provision of 3.22, or 322. Now,
Let me make sure I understand that. But if the legislature appropriates less than the FBC,
yes, sir,
fines, then it doesn't have to be, it's not necessarily going to be spent, but the comptroller must subtract that difference out of what's available for spending in other,
that is correct,
in other areas.
That is correct. Now let's flip the example. That is absolutely correct.
So we could run a surplus for one.
Yes. These studies now that you list here in your column on your chart, they're all in-house studies by the education agency, are they not?
No, sir.
Are there separate committees making each study?
No, what happens is what has happened, the old system had them, they were studied by TEA staff in order to make recommendations to the State Board of Education, which in turn made recommendations to the legislature in the regular call session. Now, the current system is to have the studies under the control of the Legislative Education Board, the Legislative Budget Board, and through the hearings process, and because the Foundation School Fund Budget Committee is an administrative agency within the Administrative Procedures Act, to actually provide public testimony, public hearings, and a record, which is judicially reviewable, for the creation of the financing components.
So it's the staff of the education agency and the legislative budget board working together that make these studies?
Well, let me give you an example. The cost of education index and the adoption of that, which was just done by the Legislative Education Board, Legislative Budget Board, there was a panel of four outside experts that advised independently of the agency and of LEB staff, the Legislative Education Board, Legislative Budget Board. Staff work, some of the work was in fact done by the education agency in terms of coming up with the numbers, using the data, coming up, running statistical analysis.
But there are no outside citizen members.
The four advisory panel members were all outside citizen members. And yeah. Those are the ones that dictated the research and quite frankly designed the formula.
Well, now are these committees institutionalized by Senate Bill 1, that they're ongoing, continuing? Studies are they time limited?
They are time limited in that Senate Bill 1 requires the Legislative Education Board and the Legislative Budget Board to complete and make recommendations by October 1 of every even numbered year. Now, quite frankly, because
but it's ongoing from year to year.
Right, and that's why I have on this graphic that once we go to the legislative appropriation for the biennium, we repeat the cycle. Quite frankly, the interim work is going to be ongoing because the nature of these studies is that it takes a long time to do it. Now, we don't anticipate capturing the four advisory committee members are not going to be there for the rest of their lives. They may well be replaced and they'll come and go with respect to that. But those are outside citizens that are informing the process.
But the committees are institutionalized.
The committee that actually makes the recommendations, the Legislative Education Board and the Legislative Budget Board are statutorily defined. The Foundation School Fund Budget Committee is statutorily defined in 16.256A. So those are ongoing committees. The membership of the Foundation School Fund Budget Committee is set by virtue of specific office holders, and about half the Legislative Budget Board and Legislative Education Board are defined, actually three on each side, Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker, the Chairs, and various committee members and several discretionary members in each side, in each house. So those are ongoing committees that have pre-existed this. They have been given significant new functions. Now,
you say they pre-exist Senate Bill 1?
Yes, sir. Now,
so then Senate Bill 1 really didn't make significant changes here.
No, sir. What the most significant change is this, is that this whole group of studies, the Legislative Education Board, it was against the background in which the funding components were set by general law. The difference in the current system is those are they are presumptively set for the implementation period. So that's the minimum. But they are no longer set by law. That is that these by delegated authority from the legislature have the authority to change without going back and amending the statute. The funding components of Chapter 16, and to make those adjustments based upon not how much money's left over. They read your opinion, believe me, in terms of on an if funds are left over basis, and created a front-loaded, prior to the legislative session started, research-based provision for defining the elements of cost. In the school finances.
You described that as the most significant change that was made in response to our opinion.
That is absolutely the most significant change in response to your opinion. Now, in addition to that, the other major components were the 70-cent tax rate. We have gone from a 33% local fund assignment to a 41% and then to a 70-cent tax rate. They have also increased the second tier significantly. And by the way, the $2,128 figure is the accountable cost number. That they took the second year. Actually, it was $2,100. The $28 was for counselors. that they costed out high school counselors that they were going to put in the bill, but they didn't. So that's where they got the number. It was, in fact, based on research. Now, what happens under Senate Bill 1 is demonstrated by this chart. And those are, that's in the appendix to the brief. And these are the exhibits that Judge McCowan found were accurate, but he questioned the assumptions upon which they were made. Let me step back a second.
They were accurate based on perhaps inaccurate assumptions?
Well, we're not sure. We're not sure. Well, he didn't give us any hint about which assumptions that he did. Now, let's go back. This is House Bill 72. And what the legislature interpreted, now this is not the year upon which you decided it. This is the 88-89 school year. What the legislature interpreted from your opinion was that local unequalized enrichment was not per se abolished. It is just that it was because of the pervasive nature of local unequalized enrichment that led to the inefficiencies in the system. That some local unequalized enrichment was tolerable so long as it was not pervasive. And quite frankly, any other system is going to lead to one of two things. If you hold otherwise, there are two and only two options. One is to cap it, and two is to do recapture, which is in essence a cap, but then we have the Love versus City of Dallas problem.
Well, there's no language in the prior opinion about so long as it's not pervasive. Doesn't it say solely related to tax effort?
Right. And what that was read by is back to, and we put it in our brief, was back to the debate between Mr. Justice Bossie and Mr. Justice Hightower at the Constitutional Convention in 1974, in which that same debate took place. And very similar language emerged. And it was understood at the time to say that some local enrichment, purely local, no state match, would be tolerable so long as you had an efficient system. That's how they read that. Now, that sentence is somewhat confusing, to be sure. But the legislature read that thing as saying, yeah, there will be some local unequalized enrichment. Now, if you meant something different than that, then you need to say it, because that was not understood the way that you have interpreted it.
You're saying that you advised the legislature to interpret this court's opinion of last year and the solely based on tax effort, based on some debate that two justices had in 1974?
It looks like the same argument to me, and it looks like the assertion of the same language in the opinion was very similar to the language that was in the proposed constitutional amendment that, in fact, passed, but probably for other reasons. It looked very like a very similar debate. That's a confusing sentence. Make no mistake about it. To folks that are trying to be out there and in good faith try and figure out what the intent of the Supreme Court was. And when you say solely from local tax effort, and when you say that once an efficient system is reached, then local enrichment is a term of art. That means local unequalized enrichment, quite frankly. That's a term of art in the school finance business. And then you say, once you've got an efficient system, you can do this.
Now, is that defined in a statute?
No, sir. That's simply a term of art in the school finance business.
If you go to a convention of school financiers.
The legislature thought they knew what you meant when they did it. Now, like I said, if you didn't mean it, then you need to tell them. Because that's how it was interpreted.
Go ahead and say, once you have an efficient system, do you agree with what I took as Hunter's response to be to my earlier question that the escape of revenues which would otherwise be available to the school funding system from more wealthy districts is an inefficiency, but it is one that is necessitated by the structure of the equalization plan?
I agree with that, but I think that both you and Ms. Hunter are a bit confused about the order of magnitude of the problem. Let's look at where we are at here.
So the state did not agree that it's $470 million?
No. That is not. There's taxes out there. But it is not that the rich districts are not paying any taxes. They're certainly paying taxes. They've got a tax rate in the 60 to 70 cent range. They're not taxing at $1.18 under the system. You're losing something. There's no question about it. But it's not like they're getting off free. The only way that you can get back, the only way that you can get at that additional money is essentially a statewide tax. Now, you can do it directly, but that involves Article 8, Section, it's 1E, it's not 3E. Or you can do it with a recapture provision, but we've got luck.
So what is the amount of the loss?
Pardon me?
What is the amount of the loss?
The amount of the amount of loss that is calculated in terms of what they call loss of budget balance is about, in terms of, depends on how you look at it. What are you looking at, state funds?
Or look, looking at it some way, what is the amount of if it's not $470 million,
it's about
two, what the trial court found, what is it?
It's about $200 million.
So that loss of revenue, which would otherwise be available to the funding system, it is your position that that's simply a necessary result of the structure of this equalization plan?
Yes. I mean, any time that where you're trying to match, in some respects, the unmatchable, that is, as you're attempting to superimpose state taxation revenues on top of a locally raised system, that you're going to get some dysfunction in terms of the tax raising. That exists not only for school districts, that exists for every political
system. Constitution requires that superimposition to be vice versa. I mean, the state has a responsibility to make suitable provision for an efficient system, and they can use local revenues to help meet that responsibility, but they must do so in a way that meets some standard of efficiency, which is to some extent judicially reviewable. It cannot be left solely to the legislature.
Now, what the legislature chose to do was to draw the line. There's two ways where you can get inequities in the system. The legislature decided that line, which is the 95th percentile, that was the point beyond which they weren't going to chase it anymore. That was the line drawn. Trial court said that the 95th percentile, that he was ambiguous on the 95th percentile clause, frankly. Now, the 95th percentile is extremely widely supported.
Well,
the term was coined by Dean Udoff at the law school. It was supported by two governor's committees. It was supported by the Equity Center. It was supported by virtually everybody in the legislative process.
Is it also undisputed that it excludes 124 of the wealthiest school districts and 174,182 children?
It excludes them from the equalized system. It does not exclude them from being taxed for the provision of education.
In other words, you don't consider those 124 school districts or those 174,000 children and how much is being spent on them when you proceed to define an efficient system.
When I proceed to define an efficient system in terms of measuring under the statute,
in terms of any kind of comparison with whether the educational opportunity is at all similar.
Well, yes, we do. And yet let's look at the district at 550. That's Alamore. Alamore ISD has got a tax base of $21 million, which for a school district isn't very big. It's out in the middle of nowhere. The reason why it's got a $21 million property value is it's got a TAP plan in it. It's got two kids. That's why it has a high property wealth. And it's got incredibly high expenditures. They're spending $15,000 a kid. But that's one teacher and somebody to cut the grass, such as there is. That's it. And the air conditioning bill. There are some out there are those kids getting, they're getting a heck of a lot of money spent on them. Are they really getting a quality education? The answer is no. And Senate Bill 1 attempted to deal with that, by the way, for the first time, uniquely in the state of Texas, in the history of school finance, the Commissioner of Education can do away with districts like that. Now, it takes 2 years. They have to be academically unaccredited under the new statute for a period of 2 years before the commissioner can take action. But if they are, he is commanded.
They have to be academically unaccredited before he can do anything to change?
Yes, sir.
A tax haven?
Yes, sir.
What does it take to become academically unaccredited?
Two kids is pretty close to it.
But
once
there were
no
guidelines given.
Yeah, there are an incredible number of guidelines, both in statute and in rules, in terms of definition of the accreditation process. But that's a whole other aspect to the job of the education agency. A tremendous number of rules that define academically unaccredited quality of program, depth of various program offerings, things.
All things that were in the statute before any of this debate.
Yes, but uniquely now the commissioner, and there have been unaccredited districts, we've changed the term. There have been districts that have existed in these categories for years, but no one, for the first time, the commissioner can actually do something about it. He can annex them to adjacent districts.
Well, so really, those problems will come. How would you let a fire burn for 2 years before you put it out?
Well, the legislature didn't give the commissioner any authority here to do otherwise.
Now, it has to be a change in the statute in order for him to do it more quickly?
Yes. And the State Board of Education is considering a proposal to deal with that right now. But remember, when you're given a commissioner of education a brand new power, people are going to be a little cautious about doling it out for the first time. This is giving the commissioner of education power to end the existence of a political subdivision in the state. There's reasonable grounds to proceed somewhat cautiously in this area. Now, the assumptions that this chart are based upon are that every district in this state that is currently below the level of $1.18 raises their taxes to
$1.18. Your time is excluded. Are you answering Justice Hightower's question?
No, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I just want to make sure I understand your position, the state's position, on the effect of Love versus City of Dallas. You still take the position, as you did earlier, that it's necessary for us to get to consolidation of tax bases, that we have to overrule Love versus City of Dallas.
No, sir. Love versus the City of Dallas has to do with recapture. Love versus, there's kind of a Scylla and a Charybdis on this Uribe Luna plan. There's two independent. If you're going to set up countywide districts, and you're going to have a local district
race. Tax bases only.
Well, you can do it in two ways. You can have a district raise it and recapture if Love versus City of Dallas is overruled. Or, the distinction between a local taxation permissible under Article 7, Section 3, and this is what General Maddox ruled, he's right. The distinguishing factor between a local tax under Article 7, Section 3 and an impermissible statewide tax is the local option election. And the problem with TAC countywide consolidation is you're going to superimpose. We have that system under Chapter 18 of the Education Code now, but it requires a local option election. If you're going to simply create these entities in order as a tax, it is a statewide tax. But if you're going to, and the problem then becomes is if we're going to set up a system, command, if you will, local option elections, Chapter 18 elections, which a legislature can certainly do, they still have to, in order to make the Article 7, Section 3 problem, to deal with that, you've got to have the local option election. You've got to let the citizens vote to impose this new taxing authority on themselves or not. That's the other problem. There's two ways to go at it.
And that's based not on Love against City of Dallas, but your interpretation of the provision in the Constitution banning a statewide property tax.
Yeah, and historical analysis in terms of what defines a local property tax, and that is the local option election. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. The Court is now ready to hear rebuttal arguments from appellants.
May it please the Court, Mr. David Richards, the rebuttal appellant. May it please the Court, I'll try to apologize. My voice went out yesterday and it's not fully returned. Mr. Chief Justice Phillips, you asked about Alamo Heights and Edgewood and projections. The record would show you that if Alamo Heights went to a $1.18 tax rate, which is the out-year equalization figure, it would have revenues of $7,026. Edgewood would have revenues of $4,800.
That's in 94-95?
That's in 94-95. That's the projected target of a $1.18 equalization. Highland Park at a $1.18 would have $12,100 per student in revenue, Wilmer Hutchins would have $4,800 in revenue, $1.18 under the statute. Now, that's state's projections. Now, I have to say to you, of course, that the thing that Mr. O'Hanlon put up here, of course, ignores the existence of Highland Park and Alamo Heights and treats those districts as not relevant to the consideration.
Because they're, so in, they're in the
5% that's not in the calculation. There are other problems, by the way. Before you become too enamored of Mr. O'Hanlon's chart that he's put here, his J chart there, we'd like to at least point to out some other problems with his assumptions. First, it's based on all revenues. Now, the statute requires him, of course, to exclude co-curricular and extracurricular revenues, so that is an initial problem with this projection. It assumes that these committees, which are going to begin to function, are going to put all revenues in the equalization formula, although by admission of Mr. Moat during the testimony and Mr. O'Hanlon in colloquy with the court, these committees that are going to be created, or still exist, frankly, are just going to have different functions, can't exclude any revenues they don't believe to be relevant. And this was in the testimony of Mr. Moat, this was the, quote, astroturf factor, that the legislature just didn't want to give everybody an equal shot. And there might be expenditures that rich districts made and didn't think poor districts ought to have a shot at it. No one particularly cares for astroturf, but obviously within that rubric, a lot of stuff can slip out the door.
Swimming pool.
Planetariums. It also assumes, of course, that no districts tax above $1.18 that are not already at $1.18. Well, we know from the record that there are already over 200 districts above $1.18 today. We know that we now have, if you read the morning paper, over $100 million shortfall coming this year because so many districts already moved their tax rates up. We know that the equalization target for this year of 91 cents, over 600 districts are already taxing over 91 cents. So that we've always argued along the way here that their targets are awfully low. In any event, so don't, there are a lot of assumptions in that J exhibit which simply are fallacious from our point of view. We struggle with remedy, and I don't have, and Mr. Justice Heck last time around ran it at us, he's run it at us again today, and I said, we said all along, there probably is no single path to Jerusalem or anywhere else in this area of school finance, but there are a variety of things that can be done well within the Constitution as we would see it, and there is no reason to continue so many of the inefficiencies that are admitted in this system. Now, Alan Barnes of the Texas Research League, and it's all in evidence, undisputed, we still fund by the small formula. I mean, we encourage inefficiency in this funding system. Barnes' testimony, undisputed, is we waste $200 million annually by encouraging districts to stay small because we recognize they're inefficient. Now, that's the school funding system that is perpetuated in this in Senate Bill 1. We have argued. I have stated, I think, when I was here before, and I'll say it again, I have never felt there was any constitutional impediment to tax-based consolidation or countywide taxing units. As a matter of fact, there are a number of existing countywide taxing units today. Harris County has a countywide tax. Dallas County has a countywide tax. There was an equalization tax put in and held to be constitutional in Henderson County, no, Rust County, in the 1930s. There is a South Texas district.
All of that.
Well, 8 Section 3 means, and I, at times it seems to me it's worthwhile to look back at it, it says the legislature shall be authorized to create districts and to pass laws for the assessment and collection of taxes in all said districts. Then goes on to say, the legislature may further provide that local districts can tax for further school purposes upon the vote of the people. Now, I admit, so what General Mattis's opinion has done is, in effect, run the vote of the people on the local district tax over as a condition on the specific empowerment of the legislature to authorize to pass laws specifically collection of taxes in all said districts. So, I mean, I'd invite you to look at the Constitution. Those two provisions came in simultaneously. in the original form that was separated by a period, it's now become a semicolon and later amendments, but it's perfectly apparent that that local vote of people had no relationship to the legislature's power to impose taxes under Articles 8, Section 3 and create districts. At least that would be my reading of the statute. Constitution, I'm sorry.
So in answer to my question,
I think that's one of the things that has to be explored. I don't think anyone thinks that we ought to maintain tax haven districts. We talk about Alamo, that's silly. Two students, we talked about the Berezet district, had one graduating senior. Now why? What in the name of heaven would justify the continuation of that? It's a county in West Texas with four school districts in. And if you look, one of the most intriguing things is to look at a map of the state of Texas and all the school districts in it. And it's in evidence, and it is an education in itself to see just what a haphazard system it is. We have plenty of places where countywide school districts exist, both in East and West Texas. In both East and West Texas, that I mean populated and sparsely settled places, you'll find dozens of school districts in one county, and the next county will have one. I mean, it's just so haphazard, and those inefficiencies run through it. And it is a snake that no one's wanted to pick up. The Connie Commission tried in the Coxie Report in 1964, Gilbert Aiken tried it in 1948, and indeed there was a 1930 study, all of whom said the same thing. None of whom have ever been acted on.
I understand your answer then that, as was Mr. Gray's, that tax district consolidation is one alternative, ultimate solution. I'm a bit less clear, though, as to what the position of the plaintiff intervenors is in this proceeding in terms of what remedy they're asking for the court if you're not agreeing with the plaintiffs.
I'm sorry. Well, I would state to the court this. We do not believe that this court at this stage of proceedings could conceivably implement a plan. We do agree that with the plaintiffs, the timetable is structured by the trial court, we think violates your mandate. I think that's also a jurisdictional basis for us to be here. And that the timetable adopted by the trial court are, in fact, unworkable and will place us in exactly the same posture next summer that we were last summer, with everybody coming in wringing their hands and saying, it's too late for us to do anything. And so we would urge the court, if you're inclined to, as we hope you are, affirm the opinion, is to set in motion some process, whether it's a master appointed by this court or the trial court or someone, developing an alternative plan that can be put in place in the event the legislature doesn't respond. And I do think, although it is not, I mean, it's an advance, I agree, but at least it puts the court in the posture that it's not entirely frozen and can't act in the face of legislative failure again, so that at least there's an alternative out there. And I don't mean to say that the courts ought to whip the legislature around the head and shoulders, but the existence of an alternative plan we've seen at least last time around had a certain impetus in terms of getting the legislature moving, albeit in our
For an injunction at a future date that is stayed until that future date?
Well, that's more narrow, I suppose. I would urge the court to consider seriously directing the trial court to immediately begin the process of holding hearings and trying to develop alternatives. So there will be something in place by May 1st as an alternative in the event the legislature doesn't act by May 1st.
And are you feeling that there's a need to give the legislature more specifics so that we have an efficient system rather than just a politically expedient system?
Yes, Your Honor. I quite agree. It's clear that from listening to Mr. O'Hanlon, the legislature didn't pay a whole lot of attention to what you said last time. I don't mean to sound too country about it, but I mean, you did say that you want to see a system changed, and if there ever was a perpetuation of the past, it is Senate Bill 1. I mean, the thought that you create another committee and that represents a fundamental change is a fairly shocking notion, given the levels of bureaucracy that we already function in the education industry. The only other, matter I wanted to say, if the court had no question, was that, as we see it, Senate Bill 1 actually weakens the existing mandate of 16.001. And that's the intriguing thing, that the statute had that command of equal opportunity when we argued this case before. And now what they've done, they've taken that command that every student should have essentially the same opportunity and said, well, every student up to 95% should have it, and that they should have it not for all revenues, but for a certain limited number of revenues, excluding extracurricular and co-curricular, and including those revenues which senior policymakers in the testimony of the defense don't think really are worthwhile for educational purposes.
How much deference does the court have to give to the legislative determination of what suitable provision for an efficient system is? And that's a rhetorical question, but I'm getting to this point. Is your central argument that the funding system that the legislature has devised is simply not good enough? It's too unequal to be efficient? Or is it that the legislature has now twice made definitions? They've decided what a suitable plan is, and then they haven't gotten a mechanism to really see that that's funded in an efficient way.
I suppose we, since we want to win on whatever possible theories we can think up, that the we say several things. We say at one level, and there's a sort of skill and shrimp is here, we say the legislature didn't come up with anything. But we don't want to get caught then that we're premature in our lawsuit. But I mean, the truth of the matter is, they've done nothing but create new study groups. Now that's essentially all they've done. And at the same time, they've perpetuated virtually every inefficiency that you first, from this, your opinion, first designated one of the problems in the existing law. Now, and the only corrective mechanism that they say they have in place, to wit, statistical significant differences up to the 95th percentile, is a weakening of the promise of House Bill 72. I mean, it weakens the original promise. Now, that's been the legislative response, pure and simple. And it fails, it seems to me, at every juncture. And they haven't addressed the central efficiency question whatsoever. They've done nothing.
Well, we said earlier that you needed to change the system itself. You told us today that the legislative response, if any, to change the system was to weaken it. The question I have is it possible to build a constitutional system based on the fundamental premises of the minimum foundation program as enunciated in the Gilmer Aiken Act of 1949?
Well, that's been one of the things that sort of worried me in terms of whether, I think one of the problems here is more a structural problem, but no one has ever, none of us have backed off and said, were we wrong when we started? I don't know whether we were right or wrong. I will say to you, when the trial court asked us about remedy, I said one of our fundamental problems in this case, and it's a fundamental problem before you today, is that we let the state defends its product on saying there is no solution. And so they try to persuade the trial court that although this isn't perfect, there's no other solution. So we spend all our time fighting with the state, who has all the information and all the data and all the experts, over whether or not there are possible solutions. That we have never brought the state, that is the state and its mechanisms, to the table to say, let's look at everything and decide if we went forever into this, or is it going to perpetuate the inequities? No one's even suggested anything that radical, but that seems to be the court's opinion, suggests that at least there ought to be a reexamination of those assumptions.
Well, do you have an answer?
No, I don't have an answer. I have a great cut line. I have a great cut line. I think we just ought to leave that to the next governor. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess and will return to hear arguments in Delaney versus University of Houston.
Audience, please rise.